In late October of 2017, I decided to take a trip to Japan, just for the sake of escaping the rat race and having an adventure and experiencing something new. I flew out of Heathrow and landed in Tokyo. I had 2 weeks to spend by myself just traveling Japan and seeing the sights. After the first 3 days of exploring the cities, I decided to hit a few local tourist hotspots, one being a particularly well-known forest, where people are known to enter and never return. Upon entering this forest, the first thing I noticed was the sensation of how heavy the air was, and how it felt very oppressive and cold. I was immediately uneasy, and the only thing that kept me walking forward was the knowledge that if I turned back, it would have been a waste of an entire day of my vacation. There were moments when I forgot how uncomfortable I was, and occasionally I was able to admire the place for its beauty and peaceful nature. The forest was much too large to explore in its entirety. I decided to hike for about an hour on the main path, then return on a different path. I was very apprehensive about getting lost. After a while, I sat down in a sunny spot, unpacked my bag, and began to eat the food that I had brought with me. I was nearly finished when a Japanese man appeared from the woods right next to me, as though he had been hiding there. He was wearing a business attire with a shirt and tie, but he looked very disheveled and confused. We looked at each other for a moment before I stood up and extended my hand and said, "Konnichiwa." The man clearly didn't expect to run into anybody, but he gave me a nervous smile in return and shook my hand. He knew some English and I knew a passable amount of Japanese, so we sat down and had a short conversation. I didn't pry into what he was doing there, but he asked me where I was visiting from, and we spoke about my home country of England for a while. After the conversation ended, I asked him in Japanese if he was okay, and if he needed help. He stood straight up and smiled at me, and nodded, saying in broken English, "This is beautiful place. Enjoy it for me, please." Then he walked off. The tone of his voice gave me the chills. Now a part of me wanted to run after him and stop him, grab him and keep talking to him, and perhaps persuade him to leave this forest with me. But another part of me was reluctant to get involved. I sat there, wondering who I was to interfere with this man's life. I sat for an hour, hoping the man would return, but he never did. I packed up my belongings, returned to the path, and headed back the way I came, deciding I just wanted to leave. As the sky began to grow dark, the weight of the forest's grim reputation started to weigh heavily on my shoulders. I began to move quicker. When I was nearly out, I stopped as though I hit a brick wall. At this point, it was almost completely dark, and there was still no sign of the man that I had spoken to before. Part of me tried to assure myself that he had taken another path, but the more rational side of me knew that wasn't the case. I pulled out my flashlight and made my way back into the woods. I continued back up the path at a brisk walk, occasionally calling out, "Konnichiwa," and shining my light around to signal him. When I got to the tree that I had been sitting at for lunch, my heart sank. A single string had been tied to one of the branches and led off into the trees. That string hadn't been there earlier. I swallowed the lump in my throat, and I carefully placed my index finger and thumb on the string and followed it into the woods. I had a sense that I knew what I was going to find, but I continued on anyway. Not out of any sick sense of morbid curiosity, but because I wanted to know for sure. I wanted to be able to tell someone with certainty what happened. I followed the string for a couple of minutes, when I paused. In the darkness ahead of me, I heard a faint crying. It was honestly so quiet that I couldn't tell if it was an animal or a human. I waved my flashlight around and called out cautiously, "Konnichiwa!" That's when the string started to violently shake. An enormous roar made my eardrums ring. I then heard a shuffle, as if something huge was finding its feet. Against the glare of the flashlight, I saw two pale eyes reflecting back at me. I then ran. I ran for my life. When I hit the path again, I didn't slow down. I tore out of that forest like every demon in hell was after me. When I escaped the trees, I ran to my car and slammed the door shut behind me. I sat there in the driver's seat breathing heavily. I then started to cry for I don't even know how long. Time was irrelevant to me. I felt an obligation to report the incident to someone. So I drove to the nearest police station and I told them everything about my encounter and the conversation I had with the man and how I tried to go back for him. I never heard back from the cops. Since returning home, I've checked the website for the latest victims found in those woods. But since I never got his name, I don't know whether or not he was found. I like to think that he exited the forest another way and returned home and is now doing perfectly fine. I don't know what kind of creature I encountered in those woods, but it was the scariest moment of my life, and I wouldn't wish it on anyone else. When my mom was 17, she and my grandparents went for a hike in the Belanglo State Forest in Australia. They had a holiday house in Berrima, which they would visit quite often on weekends, so going on hikes was common. While hiking along the trail that they had been down numerous times before, they came across a couple of abandoned hiking packs, like those massive ones backpackers have. The packs were stuffed full of clothes and food, but no one else was in sight anywhere, and there wasn't any obvious sign as to why they had been left behind. This was in the early 90s, before cell phones were common, so they couldn't contact a ranger to come and have a look at them. My grandmother immediately became concerned by the strangeness of the situation, and she convinced my grandpa that they should immediately go back to the car, which they did. A few nights later, after they returned home to Sydney, my uncle called my grandmother into the living room and pointed at the TV. Some hikers from Germany had been reported missing. They were last seen in the Belanglo Forest. My grandmother immediately cried out that her gut feeling had been right, even though technically there was no evidence that those bags they found belonged to those exact hikers. Other news reports that came a few years later in 1994 had the entire family in hysterics. The remains of the bodies have been found in the home of Ivan Milat. Milat had massacred numerous victims in the forest and is now known as the Backpack Killer and is one of Australia's most notorious serial killers. It is believed that there are still bodies that have yet to be found. The worst part about it was that the two hiking packs my family found were never linked to any of the bodies. This means that whoever owned them could still be buried in that forest somewhere. When I was 12, my family lived in an isolated house deep in the woods. I remember that it was December, just before Christmas, and we were gathered around the Christmas tree in the living room watching TV. At maybe around 10 o'clock, I decided to go to bed. My bedroom was on the ground floor, while everyone else's was upstairs. I remember I fell asleep without much trouble. But later on that night, I awoke, seemingly for no reason at all. I rolled over to face the window that sat next to my bed. The side of the house where my window faced was pressed right up against the trees. For anyone to look inside, they would have to walk through the undergrowth and duck under some branches just to come close. That was the reason that I didn't have curtains. I figured that there was no point. When I woke up, a terrible, vulnerable feeling washed over me right then. A feeling that I had never experienced before next to that window. It felt as if I was being watched. There was no light on in my room, but likewise there was nothing illuminating outside my window either. I stared at the window for a few moments, and then I sat up. I thought, and it was just a thought, that I saw a shuffle of movement outside when I sat up, but I didn't hear anything. After another moment, I laid back down. And even though I felt uneasy, I drifted off to sleep. A short time later, I don't know exactly how long, I woke up again, this time because I was freezing cold. I shivered, rolled over, and climbed out of bed. I suppose I had already forgotten about the feeling I had earlier. I left my room, walked down the hallway without turning on any lights, and entered the kitchen. As I made the turn into the breakfast area, I felt a freezing cold breeze on my face. That's when I literally froze in my tracks. The back door was wide open, and snow was collecting just inside on the floor. I saw the faint outline of tracks leading in, but none walking away. There was a ringing sensation in my ears, and for a few moments I found myself completely unable to move, even just to turn around. That's when I heard the slow, quiet turning of the door handle to my right, which led into the laundry room. I don't know exactly why I ran to the gun in the closet instead of upstairs into my parents' room, but that was the first thought in my head. Get a gun. Defend myself. I took my hunting rifle from my closet and raised it just as my parents had taught me. The gun was not loaded, but I figured the rifle alone would be enough to scare off the intruder. I saw a dark figure peek around the entrance to the kitchen. I couldn't make out any details, only that it was an adult. I'm not sure how well the figure could see me, but I stammered out, I have a gun. What the figure said next, I can remember clearly to this day. In a happy, sing-song voice, the person clearly spoke my first name and then added, I'm not going to hurt you. I'd never hurt you. I didn't recognize the voice. I had no idea who it was, but he knew me. I screamed like I was on fire. I dropped my gun and sprinted back to my room. I locked the door and hurled myself under the bed. I heard the man calling my name as he followed me down the hallway and made his way outside of my bedroom door. That's when I heard my father scream from the top of the stairs. I heard the intruder bolt back down the hall and out the door into the snowy night. It took a while for me to calm down enough to go and unlock the door for my parents. For a while, my parents pretended not to know who he was. But a few years later, when I was older, my dad admitted to me that the man was a former friend of his and had taken a special interest in me. He had repeatedly asked my father if he could take me out to go shopping or for ice cream. When my father refused, he started stalking me around our own property. I never had a clue about any of this. My parents called the police and pressed charges, but if the man was ever caught, I never heard. I ask my parents about him every once in a while, and they always say, "It's over. Don't worry." This story is not my own. It was told to me by a close friend. Back in 2012, when my friend was 13, he and his family owned a small farm in the middle of a Native American reservation, nestled among a small community of other natives. One night in July, they were having a family gathering. They gathered around a bonfire in one of the back fields and told stories of their heritage, and legends that had been passed down through the family for generations. My friend, who I'll refer to as John, eventually turned in for the night with a handful of his cousins. John hadn't been asleep for very long when he heard a manic commotion from one of the barns. He heard the horses screaming, panicking, and kicking against the walls of their pens. He opened the RV door and looked out towards the barn and saw that his father and uncles had sprinted that way already, weapons ready. They called out to the boys to remain in the RV with the doors closed. Before his family could even arrive at the barn, the noise stopped. And once they got to the doors and entered, there was no sound of gunfire. John and his cousins waited by the window for a few minutes, and when the adults left the barn, they were all speaking softly in grave voices to each other. They slammed the barn door shut and bolted them and patrolled the grounds until daybreak. John remembers watching them circle the property for a while before finally falling asleep. His father was very distant over the next few days and refused to let John enter the barn or tell him what exactly happened. Being 13, as the days went on, John forgot all about the incident, even though most of his family lingered at the farm until long after they intended to. The following week, after the family had left and the barn had been reopened, conspicuously absent of any horses, John began to notice a dark figure that would be seen lingering at the edge of their property, right where the fences ended, staring silently at the farm. Once he got close enough to the figure with binoculars to make out that it was wearing traditional native garbs, much like a shaman or a healer would wear, he never had any desire to move closer to get a better look. He would tell his parents about it, but they would always silence him immediately and tell him not to speak of it, to ignore it completely. After a while, it became difficult to ignore, however, because it would start appearing closer and closer to the house, showing up on the property, within the fence, always staring at the house. John never saw it coming or going, always just standing dead still. The family didn't discuss it, but John could tell that they all had it on their minds. Everyone was on edge, irritable, and seemed on the verge of panic. His father cut himself off from the family after a short while and almost never left his bedroom. A short time later, John started having horrific nightmares. Each time, he was slaughtered, torn to pieces while still alive, unable to defend himself. Once he awoke from one of those nightmares, convinced the dark figure was standing just outside his window, peering in at him. His siblings admitted to having nightmares as well, so they went into their father's room to speak to him. John recalled the look of hopelessness in his father's eyes. For the very first time, he acknowledged the figure. He told them the thing wanted them to fear it, but if they collectively ignored it, it would leave. That night, John awoke to find his brothers already awake and sitting up in bed, staring at the bedroom door. John could hear a low growling coming from behind it, and then, so slowly he could barely see it happening, the door swung open. Through the door, from the darkness, came the tip of a snout, then a mouth with rows of fangs. It wasn't low to the ground like a normal animal would be. It was much higher up, maybe shoulder height for an average man. John ducked under the covers, attempting to ignore it, but his brothers continued to stare. They later told him a beast, similar to a wolf or a coyote, entered the room, on its hind legs, staring at each of the beds. John's youngest brother screamed, and when he did, the thing seemed to fall over backwards, like it was being folded in half. But regardless, it landed on its legs and sprinted out the door. John heard his father's shotgun go off so close by, his teeth rattled. There was the sound of the front door being wrenched open and something tearing across the lawn, and then there was only silence. John and his brothers were crying when his father came back in. He then gathered them up and told them that they were all leaving and going to stay at their uncle's house for a while. They were never able to get any kind of explanation out of him as to what he saw that night. They stayed with their uncle for a few weeks, and during that time, John's father invited Navajo men to come to the farm and cast banishing spells and prevent the creature from returning. John and his family eventually returned to the farm, but it took him quite a while to grow comfortable being there again. The demon creature never returned. His father eventually sat him down and told him that what he and his uncles had seen in the barn and what had entered their home that night was a creature known as the Skinwalker. He told him that Skinwalkers were a part of their culture, and even though they were pure evil, there was no need to live in fear of them. If they chose to live as good people and did not fear the creature, it would never return. It's very important to keep in mind that John was never supposed to tell me this story. The Native Americans take Skinwalker legends very serious, and speaking of them in any way is practically attracting them to you. Many of you will not believe this story, and that's fine. I'd definitely rather live in a world where these things don't exist, but I do have to emphasize the respect I have for my friend. I know him very well, and I trust him, and for him to speak openly of this experience took quite a lot of guts. I guess if I had a parting message, it would be to really respect the Native American culture. They have this almost magical grandeur about them. They have faced genocide and had their lands ripped from them, and they're still around, and still hold their culture and religion very close to them, and lead incredibly spiritual lives. I personally think that's worth a lot of respect.
There's always a reason to be afraid.